And we're going to start out by talking about cleanup and winterization plans. Go on to discuss the effects on the fishermen this year in the Sound. That's going to be Dave. And then Jerry's going to cover claims. And unless Theo shows up, I'm going to finish with legislation. And then we really want to hear you guys' questions and answer them as best we can. So, to start out, the oil spill was not an accident. It was a symptom. It indicates problems with oil development and transportation, problems with the vessel traffic control system, problems with the regulatory agencies, the budget cuts of the Coast Guard, EPA, and DEC, which have effectively disabled these agencies' ability to monitor and oversee industry. The lessons we've learned from this, the Exxon Valdez spill, is that this spill is really the tip of the iceberg. The cleanup of the beaches is one part of the problem, but another part is cleaning up the way the oil industry does business. And to do this, we have to clean up state and federal legislation. It's going to be a long battle this winter. First, we'd like to address the cleanup. It's time everyone realized that no amount of money in the world is going to restore Prince William Sound beaches to pristine. Exxon has been responding to public pressure to clean the beaches. Exxon has launched an extensive campaign to cosmetically clean beaches, to polish rocks, high-pressure hot water washdown techniques. They've even considered using dispersants on intertidal zones, which is like against all the scientists' scientific attitude that I've spoken with. Public relations are not going to clean our beaches. We need to reevaluate what it is that we want and what would be effective. This summer, Exxon started by removing the gross contamination off the beaches. That was working. They were using gentle flushing techniques. But then they set this magical pullout date of September 15th. And the gentle wash techniques were going too slow. So the water pressure gradually got turned up, and the water temperature got turned up. Somewhere we crossed a point in time where the beach cleanup was actually doing more harm to the environment than good. And several regulatory agencies expressed this to me. And that it just sort of happened, and no one really knew how to stop it. Everyone knows from the Amoco Cadiz that high-pressure, hot-temperature washdown techniques, the beaches that they had been applied on, took longer to recover than beaches which were left alone. And yet we were doing the same techniques, again, in Prince William Sound. The beach cleanup should not be evaluated in terms of the amount spent, the number of people employed, the tons of equipment brought up here, but rather in the effectiveness. And it's pretty obvious the cleanup has largely been ineffective. Just on Friday of last week, we went out, the Cordova fishermen went out and collected rocks from the beaches, from Smith Island, environmentally stable rocks. And the night before the protest, we packaged all these rocks in 650 Ziploc bags, and they just like smeared the inside of the Ziploc bag. And these were all sent back to the National Wildlife Federation, which in turn took them to all the congressional delegates. So we just feel, we were just saying that back as a token of what's left on our beaches, and as an example that these cleanup techniques are ineffective. The technology simply does not exist right now to restore these beaches to pristine. So what can Exxon do? What can we expect? Well, we've got some ideas. We're not talking pullout, for starters. We're talking scale down, a permanent scale down. This winter, we feel that they should conduct aerial surveillances to monitor the movement of oil on the beaches after storms, after the extreme low and high winter tides. Strike forces should be maintained in the local communities, which can be mobilized to clean up sheen that's headed towards environmentally sensitive areas. Equipment should be stored in local communities so that there's ready access for the strike forces to take this stuff out to the beaches. technology should be tested throughout the winter. I mean, the state of the art right now is pretty dismal. It's like dark ages. So let's continue testing technology throughout the winter. And also we should have, most importantly, long-term studies to advance the state of knowledge of science. And we're pleased that the state winterization plan, which I just had a chance to read yesterday, covers many of these ideas that I just spoke about. So we want a permanent scale back. We don't ever want thousands of workers on our beaches again. It's ineffective. And it also, what we're trying to accomplish here is speedy recovery of the environment and also the communities. And having these big bucks in these small towns just really, it was almost as bad as the oil spill itself. So we feel that these winterization plans should probably be adopted as the plan for the future. Exxon should also consider dedicating funds to building sanctuaries to protecting wildlife and fish to aid their recovery from the oil spill. For example, they could dedicate funds to buy back timber rights to lands that are slated for clear cutting. And this is really critical because if any of you have, in your travels over the Sound, or before you leave, you ought to ask pilots to take a sweep over Two Moon Bay. We've got clear cutting going on right now in Prince William Sound. And probably the long-term effects of clear cutting are going to be felt a lot more on fish and wildlife than this Exxon Valdez oil spill. This is like an immediate hit in the environment. It's going to take years to recover from some of this clear cutting. So maybe buying back timber rights would be a good option. Also, the entire oil industry needs to dedicate funds and effort to preventing environmental oil contamination. And here, we're talking about tankers, redesigning tankers. If we're going to have marine transport of oil, we need to prevent spills. And what we're keying on here is tankers. We need these guys to get creative. Bow thrusters, double hulls, thicker hull plating, shorter links, containerized cargo. And what we have, one of our handouts here is from a science and technology article in The Economist. The vacuum method of sealing tankers is sort of like when you suck up water in a straw and you cap your finger over the top of it. If these tankers were vacuum sealed, if they did hit a rock and were holed, then maybe the oil wouldn't reach out. Apparently this idea has been kicking around the oil industry for over 3 years and at some fairly high levels, and it hasn't been taken up anywhere. I think it's time to make some noise on these issues. The oil industry, well, I'm calling it the cool hand Luke syndrome. They have an attitude problem. It's like the technology exists in some instances to do a better job than they're doing, and they're just not employing this technology. And an example of this is the Alyeska terminal, which more oil reaches enters the ocean each year from a variety of sources than from major oil spills. And here, like the Alyeska terminal is a classic example. The entire facility, we want this entire facility to be reviewed and upgraded as originally promised by the oil industry that is not kept up to date with wastewater treatment and pollution control. And I just want to finish again on this attitude problem. We're going to have oil spills, which are symptomatic of problems, as long as the oil industry has this attitude problem. On one hand, they're trying to work with citizens, like with the Alyeska Citizens Advisory Committee. You know, they've employed citizens, and they're saying, well, these guys are helping us do monitoring, and we're including their ideas. But on the other hand, the oil industry is fighting in courts the new NPDES permit, in which the regulatory agencies have significantly reduced the hydrocarbons in the discharge. So the oil industry's, and they're also resisting this terminal, the audit of the terminal. So the oil industry's attitude hasn't changed a bit. And we're going to cover the second cleanup. We have cleanup of our beaches, but we also have cleanup of state and federal legislation, and we're going to cover that at the end. So now we're going to go on into fishing effects.
I'm here on fairly short notice, but I am a fisherman in Prince William Sound, have been for a number of years. father was a fisherman, not in Prince William Sound. One of the things that we've had to try to deal with this summer as a result of our recent contact with the Exxon Corporation is to educate them in our way of life and how we ended up here and chose to be here. And we're not here by accident. We're people who have chosen to be here through a series of conscious choices. One of those things that worked in an area that we felt was in a fashion, in an area that was environmentally positive for us. A lot of us had jobs or occupations or careers in places that were not helping to us in one way or another. We've chosen to be fishermen as refugees from that. And for us, it's very unfortunate we've had to come in contact with the oil industry in the fashion that we did this summer. But what's happened to us as fishermen is, yesterday I wrote across from Anchorage on the plane with a lady from Mutual Broadcasting System. She asked me what my title was, and I forgot to tell her. I've been passing myself off as a fisherman with briefcase, is my present title. Because now when you walk in the offices, they'll see you as they know what we are. And we're getting a rapid education in how to deal with some of these things that are going on. But from a fisherman's standpoint of view, our year has four segments that are seasonal, and each is important to the year as a whole for us. And we started out our year, we have a clear observable cycle in our fishing year. In the early in the spring, we start working on our gear and our boats and getting ready and everything, our equipment. We start borrowing money because we're usually out of money about that time to get our equipment ready in anticipation of a future season. We always hope for a good run. We don't know. We look at the fish and game predictions. We have our own feelings of what the markets will be and how the season will run. And so we make expenditures on our equipment and put amounts of energy into the upcoming fishery on the basis of how we feel that we anticipate that fishery to be. In 1989, we were anticipating probably the best year in Prince William Sound, the history of the Sound here. We were anticipating a year in which all the economic factors were positive for the fishermen finally ending up highly profitable in the Sound. Big fish runs as a result of fishermen reinvesting their money into the hatchery programs in the Sound and enhancing the Sound. Good returns of the wild stocks, and excellent price because there's a high demand for the pink sound, which are one of the principal fisheries in Prince William Sound. So for us, everything, anticipation is high. It was a positive spring. Everybody was feeling high. We were getting ready to go out and reap the rewards of some long-term investments. Many of us fishing the Sound, I've been out here for 12 years, but some of us longer than that have made some big sacrifices over the years to build up the brood stocks and to get the money in place for some of these hatchery programs. And this was a year we were going to collect all that. And I believe that the processors, the canneries, were anticipating a large year themselves. A lot of additional processing capacity was brought in. The flavors were coming into the Sound. We developed a high level of confidence in the Prince William Sound fishery and its ability to produce a high quality, bright fish for fresh in the canned market. Along about March 24th, as all of us now know, unfortunately, the Exxon Valdez around the Rock Supply Reef, and everything went into a tailspin from that point in time. Early on in the spill, I thought perhaps the salmon fisheries would be exempted from the disastrous effects of the oil in the Sound, and it really didn't. It wasn't clear to me how it was going to affect us. It was clear that the herring fishery was going to be directly impacted, in as much as the herring, well, the herring are harvested for in the Sound is a sack roll harvest. The herring are harvested, the principal utilization is the roe. It's a high quality food product for Japan, and harvested a number of different ways. Fish in the hole, and the roe is taken from shelf, which is located and put in pens in the water, in the beaches of the area of the oil spill. Clearly, no one wanted to eat anything like that, and clearly there was no way to have an orderly fishery under those circumstances, so they had no herring fishery. The salmon fishery, as much as it opened several months earlier, I felt personally that it was probably going to be all right. Unfortunately, the oil continued to vomit out of the sound, and it was fairly apparent early on in the game that we were all not even thinking that man presently had the technology to deal with this type of oil spill. And that's one of the big lessons we've learned, is we don't. And as a result of the fact that large portions of the sound were heavily oiled, and there was oil on the beaches, it became readily apparent that we were going to have to take some fairly unique measures in managing the fishery in order to have a fishery. And so we formed a task force, and the task force decided that the areas that were heavily oiled, we would not be able to fish in. There would be no way to have a fishery, and to ensure that oil fish and gear and boats didn't get involved or together in some fashion that oil fish might enter the market. So we lost roughly 50, in an area in which we normally catch 50% of the fish was completely closed to fishing this year. There was no harvest there at all. There could be no harvest. We don't know if there will be a harvest in the future. We hope there will be. As a result, the fishermen, and that is all of the fishermen, were confined to a very small portion of Prince William Sound. And some fish, I don't have a map for you here, because if you saw the map, I could draw for you the picture of the area that was available for the fishery and the area that's traditionally available, the problem would become readily apparent to you. But as a result of the spill in the outlying area, and the presence, the continued presence of oil, and the presence of 10,000 roughly people on the beaches and large amounts of equipment, we couldn't have a fishery in those areas. We ended up concentrated in very restricted small areas in what we call the terminal harvest areas. Contamination in their fishing gear, in their nets, and on their boats. And it was indeed proved later to be more so crude oil through some exhaustive lab tests that determined that. And early on in the game, it was implied that the fishermen were spilling oil deliberately to avoid fishing and to collect money from Exxon. And that's why I opened with the first statement. We're not here by accident. I'm a fisherman by choice. I'm not a fisherman because I couldn't do something else. I have a degree from the university. I have been a consultant to the state of Washington. I'm not here because this is the only thing I can do. I'm here because this was a good logical choice. It's a pleasant place to fish. With a respect, entrepreneurial or aggressive group of people, and we resented the fact that it was being implied in the press by Exxon, I'm sure, was saying that the fishermen were oiling their gear so they didn't have to go fishing, because that's the furthest thing from the truth. Anyway, we didn't finish the trials, we got oil gear, the fishery was closed down. And the fishery was closed down through a process, a memorandum of understanding, and a zero tolerance policy decided early in the game by the Department of Environmental Conservation, the state of Alaska. And we sat on the beach while overflights monitored the area and looked to see if oil was present. And basically, we lost 9 or 10 days right at the peak of the season. The salmon appear in Prince William Sound, and salmon appear in all places like a bell-shaped curve. The fish start to dribble in early, and then there's a very perceptive peak of the season when a large volume of fish are entering the sound, and that is the peak of the fishery. Salmon are available really only during that period of time. You can go out and fish all your land before the salmon are here, but there's nothing there, and people do it all the time. You can throw fish, they can open the season in March, and there's simply no fishery. So it's very important for us to be there at the same time the fishery were. Salmon are going through the districts in a very early fashion, readily predictable. Unfortunately, the oil prevented us from being there at that time. So we were relegated to the terminal fishery, the extreme terminal area where the fish would ultimately go to spawn and die. And as a result, the quality of fish was very poor this year. Fishermen felt very bad about what they were doing. They were harvesting fish that, in our opinion, were of a significantly lower quality than previous harvests. And one of the things we feel we're doing as fishermen is we're contributing, we're making something that's good for people. We're catching a product that has a high value. I mean, boats down, for those of you who've been with them at the time, are beautiful. They're real. And the product that they comes from is a beautiful thing. It's a healthy thing. What we were doing this year was not. And as a result, we got involved in this game, what we call now the mitigation game, not knowing whether we were going to be, whether we were fishing for a harvest because we had the fish had indeed to be harvested, or we were worried about mitigating our losses vis-a-vis our relationship with Exxon. So the whole fishery got turned upside down. down reasonably fished and where we were fishing. 750 guys were concentrated into a very, very small area. There was normally gear problems and gear conflicts. This year those things were accelerated to a nth degree, much higher degree, because we were all concentrated in a very small area competing for a body of fish that were also concentrated there. As a result, there were contact between boats, there were collisions. The whole season was a mess. We never knew from one moment to the next whether we were going to fish or not fish. We went into a harvest mode that was basically just 12 hours long, then overflight for 24 hours to see if there was oil present in the area, and then another 12 hours. As a result, we had very erratic and spotty entrance of our product into the marketplace, which undoubtedly affected the markets. And because of all these factors, because there were oil in the normal districts and we fished, our marketplace suffered as well, and we felt that. We received very, what we considered to be minimal money for our fish this year, and we can't fault the canneries for probably telling us that the fish were not worth that much this year, because we observed it ourselves. The fish were a lot darker, they were coming in big blocks instead of a nice linear entrance into the marketplace where people would deal with them. Tenders, these are the vessels that pick up the fish from the fishermen and take them to the tenders. The tenders were being used to store fish for indefinite lengths of time, so that there were not tenders back out on the grounds to take fish from the vessels that were harvesting. The whole infrastructure to the fishery collapsed this year. And what we're afraid of is that this collapse is going to have some long-term lasting effects, and I believe it probably will, because we saw it took 5 or 6 years for the botulism scare to finally fade and disappear from our marketplace, to where we gained confidence in the world as a whole that we could produce a high-quality product for consumption. This thing that's happened to oil spill in terms of our marketplace is much larger than the botulism phenomenon. So we're afraid that we may be locked into a harvest mode similar to this year, which for fishermen is very pleasant. I wish I could come up with a similar analogy for the reporters here that you'd understand that fishermen are highly individualistic people, and we like to have room around us when we fish, and that's the most desired thing, is to have room, not see another fisherman, to have some space. And generally speaking, through some unwritten law, we give each other space out here. We spread out, we get away from each other, so each can run his harvest and do his own thing his own way. This year, we were like the rat that we put in the cage, and where we reduced the size of the cage and increased the population, and it created some very, very large-scale hard feelings for people. There's some very deep underlying animosities now that are going to take some time to fade out, that are not a result of a normal fishery, but a result of the concentration of the gear and the small areas, and the uncertainty of whether or not we would survive this year, and certainly the uncertainty for the future years. So that's basically where we are this year, what has happened to us. And we've been stressed probably as far. We are part of the ecosystem of Prince William Sound. The fishermen, the people who live here and make their lives here, we're just one segment of the ecosystem. Our lives are real closely linked to the weather, the tide. We're totally aware of what's happening with the tide at any moment, whether it's high water, low water. We make our movements are done that way in terms of fishing. Our harvests are done that way. We're aware of the weather. And we're in tune, to a certain extent, with the fish. And all of us, starting with the fish, ending with the otters and the clams and the other animals that have been impacted directly in the sound, we are part of an ecosystem here that has been inexorably altered for unknown length of time. We're feeling it in terms of stress. We're stressed just like the otters are. And the sound really can't stand much more stress. The fishermen can't stand a lot more. And the entrance of the sound of the huge volume of money that Exxon also spilled in the area was an additional stress on us. It may seem like that some of you would get clear way to relieve the problem, but it's not. It was just another stress factor. So that's where we're at right now. We're feeling better than we were in March, but we're still pretty stressed out. I'll give a little recap on the claims. My name is Jerry McCune. I'm president of Kuro District Fishermen United. This is probably the this is the first year since 1963 I never even put a net in the water. And I really don't want to do that next year. I want to go fishing. And that's, hopefully we're going to be able to do that and I can go fishing. But I'll give you a little recap on the claims here. I've been involved in this process since June, after we came up with an idea that we probably try to seek a pre-season agreement with Exxon. And so we had this idea, so we contacted Kodiak and lowered them up to Cook's Inlet to see if we could try to work something out. First, we were stonewalled for quite a long time because Exxon tried to tell me they didn't know what we were talking about. So then we finally did get secure one meeting first, and we went around and around, I think, for probably 3 or 4 weeks. And Dave was involved with that too. And lots of other fishermen were involved with that. And so we presented a program to them. They presented one back. And basically what happened was it's their volunteer program, Exxon's volunteer program. We got to change one thing, I think, if I remember right. And everything else was dictated and written by Exxon. So there wasn't any negotiating, actually. So where we're at right now is that we're at what we call the 85% program. It's based on your last 2 years fishing catch in 87, 88. Which really is kind of an unfair way to do it because you don't know when you're going to do it.
Definitely need an increase in the oil spill fund. And finally, we have to ask the congressman, do not support in any provision that limits in any way a state's right to react to a spill independently of the federal government. In other words, no preemption of states' rights. So once again, one of the reasons we got into this mess is because the outcome of much federal legislation to date has been determined by powerful oil industry lobbyists and the oil industry's allies in Congress. And to get around this, we need a grassroots effort. Let's make democracy work. Let's call our U.S. representatives. The timing is just critical. We need to do it in the next 3 days before the end of Monday. That's next Monday, September 18th. And the number again is 1-202-224-3121. We're also asking people to call two of their out-of-state friends and pass this message to them so we get this telephone tree going. And like I say, this is just critical right now. So I think on that note, I'll open it up for questions.
How many people joined
Exxon
approximately and got rid of the
joined Exxon? Well, I'm not sure. How many were employed by Exxon? How many made success in $100,000?
Let me answer that. Probably about, maybe about a third of the fleet worked for Exxon. But the way to answer that question is it's their personal choice. And a lot of the, at the very beginning, there was a lot of fear and uncertainty about the fishery. So this choice was to work on the oil spill. As far as the money figures, I'd like to put money figures out because each one of the fishermen are an individual business person, and it's actually their own business. And you know, it was just a choice that you either had to make. You know, it's a bit kind of like a business choice if you are, you know. But the other thing was too, there was a lot of fear, a lot of rampant things went around as the fish price started plundering and everything else. People have a lot of obligations that hangs on the seasons, and they usually do in August and September. So, you know, a lot of guys chose to work on the spill.
Did it have some effect on the fishing communities?
It was somewhat divisive, yes, it was. But I think at this point in time, everybody's realizing now that, you know, looking back on it, is that with the uncertainty of the season, whatever you could do to try to ensure you made your payments. You know, one of the things that people don't realize is that maybe $100,000 sounds like a big piece of money, and it is indeed a big piece of money, not to belittle that, but the obligations some of us have. I mean, these vessels and permits out here, we have, they're big investments, they're not easy to get into. I mean, we have big payments. This is not a cheap industry to capitalize. So $100,000 for using a piece of that equipment is is right on line with, you know, I don't know how, what length of period of time, that would probably be, the average lease is probably $2,500 a day for a vessel, you know, with a crew. And some of the guys were out there for 50 or 60 days, but it's, you know, you have to take a look at the industry to see how, what the level of capitalization is. We have loans that are usually most of 5 years long on these pieces of equipment. It's common to have $500,000 liability out here and have payments in September. We pay everything at once. It would scare most people. I mean, it scares me. You know, every time I see it coming in September and the season's not going well. You know, I have a fairly reduced liability, but I have about a $20,000 payment that's due in September, not including $14,000 insurance, which I have to pay in the spring when I don't have money. And, you know, another $20,000 in gear over a year and equipment. The equipment breaks down, gets overhauled. And we have, you know, it's just like any other business. You know, you'd have to understand the cash flow and whatnot. But
the whole point is that Exxon made the charter rates. We didn't. They threw the money out in the arena. It does. It really will. And why they threw it out there, I don't know. Well, because people that made money on one hand over here in the oil spill are obviously going to make more money than they did fishing or on their claim. So what you'll have over here is over-capitalization of equipment in, on this side, that people that actually did make money, and these guys over here are going to be just, you know, floating along until the next season. And then it created a lot of, you know, dissension between people. And why they did that, I don't know. I mean, regular normal treasury rates would have been just fine.
I have to compete for the next 10 years. Personally, I have to compete with equipment that was, I have no objection to individuals going out and getting on contract and making money. But I have to compete for perhaps the next 10 years with big chunks of equipment that were purchased not as a result of money extracted from our fishery. Our fishery is a nice little nutshell. The guys who make money do well and buy better equipment, and the way the money is distributed is a result of the fishery. You know, it's all kind of this internal little world. Now there's been an injection of a large amount of capital from the outside. Now there's going to be people buying big vessels this year, and people didn't have contracts. And again, I'm not belittling guys who did, the guys who didn't. I'm not going to answer that question, but we have to now compete in the fishery with the injection of capital that was not as a result of the fishery. So kind of the whole infrastructure again is the way I like to.
Okay, let me.
Fishermen made more money this year working for Exxon than they would have made.
No.
I think some did. But when I said big bucks in a small town, it's, we have to remember that these rural communities are supported by the fishing industry. And the fishermen had the boats. The fishermen went out and worked. The fishermen got the money. That money is not flowing back into the community like it does in a normal year. The guys have been out for days on end. And when they come back to town, they don't have to buy fishing gear. They don't have to buy groceries. It's totally different. There's just not the influx into the community of the money. So what we're having is the people who don't have the boats to go out on the spill, who live in the community, there's just a huge difference. And I think we have not seen the full effects of these big bucks yet, because when these people come back who've been working, they're going to take their money and they're going to leave. It's not, these communities are going to be hard places to live in this winter. I know, for example, some of the families, the people who've been out on the spill, have made enough money to completely post stakes and leave town. And I know specifically at least three families with 3 to 5 kids. Well, in Cordova, that's a lot of kids that are leaving a small school district. So what's going to happen this winter? It's going to be a mess. There just hasn't been the link between the fishing industry's money to supporting the community this year. That's really just been totally shattered. And with it, it's created a lot of resentment within the actual community itself. Again, just fear what's going to happen to us this winter.
The harmful climate is pretty
still charged. It's. I don't know how long people can live under this so much emotion. It's still pretty intense.
Ricky, could you help us understand what a lot of people from outside of Alaska, how this is affecting Cordova economically? On one hand,
Let me try to describe a normal fishing week. Say it's in the middle of summer and we've got two areas open. We've got the Copper River Flats open for gillnetters and we've got Prince William Sound open for gillnetters and seiners. Say we've got our normal fishing on the Copper River Flats, which is 36-hour opener starting Monday and a 24-hour opener starting Thursday. I guess I could say that's normal. And on Prince William Sound, we've got a three-day opener, which was pretty much what we had these last couple of years. So on Monday, boats charge out to the flats, Copper River Delta, and they charge out to Prince William Sound. On Wednesday, we have people come back to town. Their boats are broken down, their nets need mending, they employ net menders, they employ the mechanics in town to fix their boats, they buy groceries, they go out to the bar, they relax because they know they're going to have to go fishing again on Thursday, some of them. So there's an influx of money into the community. Then on Thursday, some of the boats will go out again fishing. Some of the boats charge over. The gillnetters will actually, we did this all last year. We drove, any time there was an open area, we were fishing in it, me, my partner, and I. So we'd fish Prince William Sound, and then we'd charge back to Cordova, refuel, fix the boat, mend gear, charge, buy groceries, charge back out to the Copper River Delta for 24 hours, charge back into town, do the whole thing again, charge back out to the Prince William Sound. So it's like perpetual. This is pretty wild because I was a graduate student right before I became a commercial fisherman and I'm pinching pennies totally. And suddenly we're going, I could spend more money in 1 week as a commercial fisherman than I earned as a total year being a graduate student. And it was spent in Cordova. And we're just not seeing that right now. And on top of that, we're going to have the workers come back and, they're spill workers, whether they're fishermen or other people in the community who have taken boats out. They're going to leave for the winter. It's normal that people leave for the winter anyway, a few people. They travel to exotic places. It's raining and dark up here in the winter and cold, So a lot of these people go to where it's summer, Australia, New Zealand, somewhere exotic. And I think we're going to see a lot of vacations this year just to get away from the stress. And that's going to be all this money migrating out of the community again. Anyway, it's the people that, the grocery store owners that never had access to the big bucks to begin with, they're going to be left holding down the fort in the winter, and the question is, how big is the fort going to be? Is the fort going to be big enough to support these local businesses? It's going to be pretty tight.
If I might give you an example, one of the things that's important to note, this phenomenon is not limited to Prince William Sound. I represent the group of people called the Oil Affected Fisheries, also in some negotiations with Exxon. That is the fishermen from Chignik area, Kodiak, upper and lower Cook Inlet. We're talking a long way down the pike here, 500 or 600 miles away from here. The guys got oiled and lost their fisheries. So this is a bigger thing than what we see in the Sound, although it's big in the Sound. A man who's a gear salesman approached me just recently, this weekend. He said, I've got 800 units of gear over for the guys that I normally sell to them because they wear their gear. Is the nets or the lines. When we say gear as fishermen, we mean the actual physical portion that we fish in the water. We call that gear. That can be corks, cork line, nets, lead line, all those things we call gear. So now you've had that lesson here. We have 800 units of gear. The gear being the net hole gillnet for $2,000 now, $2,500. It's been a while since I bought a gillnet. But anyway, It's a reasonable amount of money, for an individual to hold on in terms of inventory. So normally, 800 units of gear and Cook Inlet are worn out during the season. And the guys come in and they buy 800 more units of gear, fix their gear, and they store it away ready for the next year, for the season. This year, they didn't fish Cook Inlet. He's sitting at 800 units of gear. He's paying prime plus one. If they're you figure out $4,000 a piece. We're starting to talk about real money when you're talking about little stores that you're talking about as in the millions of dollars. He's got to sit on that this winter somehow and deal with it. But not only that, the next year when the fishery starts, he's got the 800 units of gear. They normally would have retired 800 units of gear. He would have sold the 800 this year and ordered another 800. He's got, he has 800 units of gear that won't be retired, so he's lost the opportunity to sell that. That's a subtle thing. Nobody dumped oil in his gear shop, nobody dumped oil on his gear. But there's a man who's directly affected and seriously affected. He's hurting, as a result of that. And he unfortunately sells gear in a number of areas. He sells at Prince William Sound, Cook Inlet, and on down the line. So he's dealing with everywhere. I mean, and there are 100 stories like that of shopkeepers, of people who sell sandwiches in the summer, who are impacted by the fact that the people who went out on the spill, as opposed to fishing, have been out there for 100 or 150 days without being in town and not spending money in the normal infrastructure that the town has. The infrastructure is here as a result of the fishery. The gear shops that sell gear are not oil shops. They're not oil cleanup shops. They sell fishing nets, and the people who have the food sell to fishermen who go out and feed their crews. A lot of the crews were not here this year. So the whole infrastructure, you know, in our towns are not unsimilar to the towns you folks are from. They're just smaller, so they're easier to understand, and they're usually single industries. Valdez is clearly an oil town. There's a lot of oil and oil money here. It's a big term. We don't have anything like that in some of the other bush communities. Homer, Seward, Real, Cordova, Chignik, Kodiak. I mean, in 100 other small towns, smaller down to the towns down to 30 or 40 individuals, we call them towns here. Those places, the structure is gone. The red's been pulled off. Remember, not intentionally, mind you. And it was probably Exxon in their largesse was thinking, well, we'll give some big contracts to these people that will help them out. Well, unfortunately, the money spill is probably as devastating as the oil spill. And that's been one of my statements here in this whole thing. And, you know, maybe you can come to an understanding of what we're talking about there.
I haven't wasted my time reading their plan. I read the states. Have you read their plan at all?
The states one?
I've read Exxon.
No, I haven't read that one. But I read the states one, but I haven't read Exxon's winter plan. Basically, I think the crux of it, I read part of it and got the gist of it, is that they're gonna monitor all winter long what the oil does and come back and reassess in the spring, which I actually think they're not going to do anything. But I like the state's approach is, and I would have been beating on Exxon all summer to take the approach that there is 1,200 ideas out here that people submitted, and some of them are not very good ideas, but some of them are, and I think some of them could be used. If we just get out there and test them instead of just using the harsh water treatment that we've been using all summer, one method. We never tried anything different besides Exxon's dispersants or Exxon's this or Exxon's that, their products. And hopefully the state, through their grant program, we're going to try some of these new methods this winter and see if anything can work.
I think the key here is that we support the state's winterization plan. And if Exxon's is significantly different than that, then there's problems with it. I haven't read it. That's what I mean, yeah.
Negotiated the fisherman's response part of it was negotiated, and because we felt real helpless at the beginning. There wasn't, you know, we kept calling, what can we do? There was nothing, obviously now there was nothing that we could do because there wasn't any boom or anything to do anything with. So all the communities are working on that, and we've been negotiating with the IESCA that we have a warehouse that has boom, we have a coordinator that can, you know, organize the boats and send them out with the boom and what we need to do to take part in the system to help out. And we want to make sure that we have that, because we're actually the experts of Prince William Sound as a fisherman. We know the waters real well, and if we can help out and they need any help, you know, we've got a warehouse full of boom right there in Cordova, Kodiak, or wherever the situation may be, and get it out. But the Prince William Sound is the key to the thing, is prevention and response. So we can try to prevent these oil spills, and if we have one, then respond as quickly as possible. Not like we did this last time without any equipment on hand. So we want to be assured. I'm not going to listen to anybody anymore, the state, the federal government, or IESCA. I want to be assured under contract that these things are going to be there and I can have access to them.
I was a little bit disappointed in the Citizens Advisory Group. I'm assuming that's what you're saying, because that's, is that the Citizens Advisory Group on the contingency?
We're still working on that, actually. The contingency plan is still being hammered out. There are phases, there are segments of it that are not done yet. There seems to be a continual turnover of some of the personnel in the plan, particularly in regard to the Coast Guard, but there are aspects of it that are still being negotiated. One of the things that became apparent early in the spill was that, you know, we had a fisherman who went out and collected, how much did Copeland get? Oil, 30,000 gallons.
Quicker than a skimmer, anyway.
Quicker than a skimmer, decentralized, with buckets. I mean, basically, we've got 2,000 or 3,000 boats up here ready, staged for a fishing season at any given time. We could have decentralized the effort, and that's part of the discussion in the contingency plan, gotten these vessels out there actually collecting oil, doing something early in the game. We probably could have prevented a lot of the oil from reaching some of the other areas, you know. And that's part of that's what that discussion is in the contingency plan. But the contingency plan is still a growing thing. It's still alive and it's being worked on.
Right, and there's several problems with it. And right now, we're about to see how well Alyeska responds to our comments on the contingency plan. I mean, that's sort of where we're at right now. We've had input through this committee on their contingency plan. They wrote the plan. The plan's back in our side of the court right now, and we're working on comments, and we'll see how seriously they take us now. I mean, that's have they set this Citizens Advisory Group up as puppets, or do they actually intend to work with us and take us seriously? I was on this Citizens Advisory Group initially, and I resigned because I felt that the goal was too short-sighted. They only wanted to address oil spill prevention and contingency plan response type stuff. And I believe that citizens should also have oversight capabilities of environmental monitoring with operations at the terminal. The terminal has been largely self-monitoring since 1982, largely because of budget cuts to the regulatory agencies. But this is ridiculous, and it's led to large problems. Non-compliance with state and federal water and air quality standards. What we need to watch here is industry really sincerely going to work with us? If they are, then we need to address all the problems, not just oil spill response and prevention. That's the most obvious one right now. Everybody's working on that. What about the ones that aren't so obvious? Is their attitude going to change? Are they going to let us address these other problems with them as freely as they are with the contingency plan?
I have another question. I
can answer that. That's okay with you guys. First, you have to understand that this area has the highest density of sea otters in the world. And otter populations are sort of like rabbit populations. They're cyclic. They depend on the food supply. In this area, otters have not traditionally been a problem for fishermen. However, the animals are at the peak of their population cycle. They're out of food. This winter, I've personally seen eating two worms, starfish, and that's not the kind of food they eat. Last year, fishing, otters don't get tangled, at least in this area, like seals and sea lions do. And the otters are not regarded as big a problem as seals and sea lions, that big a threat to the fishermen. But I've seen them kind of bobbing down the year and eating salmon heads, because it's the hard body, hard chewy part that they're used to. They're used to eating clams and hard things. So we were
sort of anticipating two things. We feel these animals are starving. The population is too high in this area. We're anticipating a population crash. And we were sort of worried that we were going to be blamed for it. And as far as helping, in this area, we just... Yeah, I guess that more response to sad thing, but people in this area live here because they enjoy, well, a lot of fishermen don't carry rifles at all. Now, they make up for that by killing as many, you know, they take other people's share of, like, the seal quota that we have, or the stellar sea lion quota. But I think there's an appreciation of wildlife and wilderness in this area. And I think we saw that in the fisherman's response to this bill.
I'll just carry one little farther. Is that the fishermen, and I'm not going to, you know, defend every 100%. I think we've been working towards the goals of cleaning up the ocean. You know, we were instrumental in helping out in that plastic bill.